I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, the founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows wine enthusiasts to access wine without removing the cork. Greg is also the founder of Intrinsic Therapeutics, a medical device company focused on spinal disorders.
My wife was pregnant. We always used to enjoy wine together. I think at first it was, look, I want to be able to drink a glass and not commit to the whole bottle. But then I realized, you know, what I really want is a way that I can drink however much wine from any of my bottles at any time without having any compromise in the quality of the remaining wine. My first medical product was a needle product. So I had become really good at needles. And I remember literally standing in my house with a needle in my hand and a bottle of wine in my other and thinking, there's got to be a way that I can get this wine out of this bottle without pulling that cork using this needle. And I think the rest was quite easy.
Coming up, we'll learn how Greg Lambrecht built Coravin from scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, the founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows wine enthusiasts to access wine without removing the cork. So if you want just a glass or two from a bottle, the Coravin extracts just a portion of the wine and replaces it with argon gas. Greg is also the founder of Intrinsic Therapeutics, a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Greg is a graduate of MIT, and he has degrees in nuclear and mechanical engineering. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
How does the Coravin work?
So the Coravin is a simple handheld system about the size of a rabbit cork pull. It works by passing a thin needle, a non-coring needle that actually was originally developed for medical purposes, through the cork. Then you push a trigger. Argon gas inflates the bottle, essentially. It increases the pressure on the inside of the bottle. When you let go of the trigger, that pressure pushes the wine through the needle and out of the spout and into your glass. You pull the needle out of the cork, and the cork, because of its elasticity, reseals. The key for us, really, is that we take advantage of the cork's natural elasticity to allow it to continue doing its preservation job. Mm-hmm. We just found out a way to get the wine out of the bottle without removing it.
Okay, so show me this. Where is the argon? Is that
the
this
capsule
here?
The capsule. The capsule actually goes in here.
Okay. So there's one in there now?
That's right. You can always tell by pushing the button. You hear that that's the argon gas coming out.
How small is the needle?
It's a little bit over a millimeter. It's a 17-gauge needle. And it's actually a medical-grade needle.
It looks bigger than I was expecting.
Oh, yeah. You know, the cork is really the most elastic natural material, the structural material we've ever found. And really what I did was take advantage of its elasticity to be able to get a reasonably large gauge needle through it to pour wine as quickly as possible.
What is the history of the cork in wine?
It's a good question. I read about it only after I developed Coravin, but the cork is really the best tested wine preservation system that we've got. Wine's been around for about 8,000 years, as far as we know. It started in Iran or the Caucasus and spread its way, like all good things, across the planet. Cork in glass is an argument between the French and the English, as there frequently is. But the best records show that it was developed by a guy who manufactured glass bottles in England in the 1600s. And he just decided that if he used cork in glass, that he could seal wine and better preserve it. The biggest problem with wine was that it would oxidize over time. You couldn't preserve the flavors of it for very long at all, so it was drunk quite young. Once he developed that system of cork and glass, people have been enjoying wine over decades since.
What is cork made out of?
Cork is it's a biologic plant-like material, and it's got a really remarkable cellular structure where the cells encapsulate a little bit of air, but it's completely contained. They're really, really small, and there's lots of them. And that air and that structure allows it to be compressed actually upwards of 90%, and it'll recover the vast majority of its size. So it's been great for sealing things for a long time.
The traditional cork is being replaced by other closures over the last decade or so. Why is that shift happening?
Well, there was a terrible tragedy that happened. Most cork is made in Portugal and by the Amaral family, I think. It goes way, way back. It's a beautiful tradition. Portugal went through some political troubles and economic troubles in the 70s and 80s, and the Amaral family really was sort of kicked out, and the farms were taken over, by people who really didn't know what they were doing. So they had bad storage practices. They had bad treatment practices that wound up producing subquality, subpar cork that wound up being shipped all over the planet, and in particular, south of the equator. So the Australians, the South Americans, and even some of the Americans in the 1980s were getting really poor quality cork that either resulted in early oxidation of their wine or the transfer of this really foul chemical called TCA. And so with those failures, the French and actually then the Australians developed the screw top, which is the most broadly used alternative closure.
And do the Portuguese, are they back in action with providing cork to the global market?
They absolutely are. And they have cleaned up their act dramatically. And the incidence of things like premature oxidation and tainting, cork taint, which is TCA, has dropped dramatically. I think when somebody comes out with a competitive closure that starts taking over, you respond.
Why does Portugal have a monopoly over the cork supply?
Trees live for 100-plus years. They take a long time to develop, and they like to grow in certain areas. So Portugal is the number one, Spain and France. It's a very European product, as I think it has been for thousands of years.
If the cork has this elasticity, why has it been so challenging to create a device such as the Coravin to preserve wine in the past or up until now?
I've always felt that the most challenging thing in developing a new product is identifying the unmet need you're trying to address. I've always felt that once you've really captured the need in a unique way, the product itself sort of falls into your hands. And I think what's been the assumption throughout history since the 1600s was that in order to drink a glass of wine, you need to remove the cork. And I think the fundamental step that I took when I invented this device was saying, no, I don't actually need to remove the cork.
Did you have sort of this epiphany moment where you're like, wait, actually, let me go about this a different way?
I'd worked on my first medical product was a needle product, one for J&J and then another one for Pfizer. So I had become really good at needles over the course of a few years. And I remember literally standing in my house with a needle in my hand and a bottle of wine in my other and thinking there's got to be a way that I can get this wine out of this bottle without pulling that cork using this needle. And I think the rest was quite easy.
And you had the coincidence of your wife being pregnant in 1999 when you came up with the idea so that you were basically alone drinking wine and you wanted to find a way to preserve the wine. Now, that's the anecdote. Is that just coincidence?
It always sounds so tragic. You're drinking alone. Yeah, it was the driver, certainly. My wife was pregnant. We always used to enjoy wine together. And actually, her taste has permanently changed as a result of her pregnancy, which is not uncommon. And there were, I think at first it was, look, I want to be able to drink a glass and not commit to the whole bottle. But then I realized, you know, what I really want and what's missing is a way that I can drink however much wine from any of my bottles at any time without having any compromise in the quality of the remaining wine.
By the way, you said your wife's taste, her name is Lee, has changed since her pregnancies. How so?
There are some good things and bad things about pregnancy. It's remarkable the vast impact that it can have on a woman's body in all sorts of unpredictable ways. And the sort of benign one that happened to my wife, she became super sensitive to smells and tastes. She's very good at picking up oxidation. She's been great in part of my testing as I developed Coravin to see whether or not wines had changed. But she really has lost a taste for strong flavored things like broccoli or truffles or wine of any kind. She's still a great wine detector taster.
So even decades after having children.
Yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink one or two glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. You use argon as the gas to prevent oxidation. And argon is a noble gas. It's an element. It's inert. And the Greek word means literally lazy.
Yeah. And it is a lazy gas, I guess. It doesn't, or it's an antisocial gas. It doesn't want to play with anybody. Doesn't bond to anything. I actually experimented with a variety of different gases over the 10 years it took me from the time I came up with the idea till starting the company. I wanted to see which gas had the least impact on wine over time. For me, the ultimate was if a professional couldn't tell the difference between a wine that had been accessed, I'd poured a couple of glasses out of the bottle years ago, maybe a decade ago, and one that had been untouched.
Yeah.
So argon very quickly rose to the top along with a few other gases, and I really wasn't able to tell the difference, as has been demonstrated by a lot of people that have tried.
Now, argon is heavier than oxygen, so it forms a blanket over the wine. Is that right?
That's right. It's about 1% of the air we breathe, but it is heavier than air. And that gives it some really tremendous advantages, both for the Coravin, and actually it's a commonly used gas in the wine industry during the bottling process.
I've heard the Coravin described as a mosquito. And for people who want to picture how the Coravin works, just as a mosquito extracts blood using a needle, so too does the Coravin extract wine. You had mosquito in the initial name, correct?
That three-year-old older son of mine gave it a very sticky name, literally from the start, wine mosquito. We dropped it because mosquitoes have also been responsible for malaria and, you know, millions of dead. So we've dropped it from our lexicon. But it was the name of the product between 2000 and 2011, when it was really just my device at home.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink one or two glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. You started Coravin from a personal need. Had you always been interested in wine?
I grew up in Southern California, probably had my first wine at a reasonably illegal age. So there's a wine culture in California, and I'd always liked it and been interested. I was introduced to one of the first most shocking wines that I'd had. It was an Hermitage from France, a red wine, and it didn't taste anything like a grape. It tasted like pepper and meat and all these strange things. And I thought, you know, how did this happen? And I think that's one of the pleasures of wine, is the exploration of how a single grape in different regions made by different people can in one place taste like blueberries and strawberries in Australia, taste like red meat in France, and be a spectacular drink in California with totally different characteristics.
And while you were a wine enthusiast, you are and were primarily a medical device inventor. At what point did you say, you know what, I'm going to take this invention of mine seriously?
I'd been making them for my own use for a while, and then one of my friends saw it, who's now one of my co-founders, and said, you know, can I have one of those? So I made him one. Then I had a very good friend, one of my investors in Intrinsic. He got married, and as a wedding gift, I made him one. Mm. And then people that they knew saw it and started asking for it. So I started making, I don't know, a dozen a month. And realized, hey, wait a minute, it's not just me who has this problem. There's a lot of people who have the same interest to try a variety of different wines and not have to commit to any of the bottles.
And this invention was marinating for, you know, over a decade. You first thought of the idea in 1999,
yep.
But it wasn't until 2003 that you developed your first prototype. And by the way, 23, 24 prototypes later, we now have a Coravin.
You know, I'm a perfectionist. It helps you in medicine because you never want to have a failure if you can help it. I am a scientist at heart. I wanted to make sure that it worked perfectly. And it was a side hobby, but it got to a point where I realized, you know, I've touched on something that people are passionate about, which is what really gets me going.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, founder of Coravin. We'll hear more from Greg coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, the founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows wine enthusiasts to access wine without removing the cork. So if you want just a glass or two from a bottle, the Coravin extracts just a portion of the wine and replaces it with argon gas. Greg is also the founder of Intrinsic Therapeutics, a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Greg is a graduate of MIT, and he has degrees in nuclear and mechanical engineering. When you say that you gave the Coravin as gifts, I mean, this, I'm looking at it, it's intricate. It's made of metal, and it's really solid. I mean, is it made in China? Or?
Yeah, it's so great. I think you look at something and it looks beautiful. Now, this is how much the world has changed. You think it must be made in China or Germany. So it's a sad truth, but actually not a sad truth. They're both great places. I have a machine shop in my basement. I'm an inventor, and so I like to relax by making things. So I have been machining since I was in college. It's just something that's very peaceful for me, designing and machining. So I made them all in my basement.
Using what? I mean, it's made of metal.
Yeah. So I would cut it, design it, and cut it by hand. I probably would have been a watchmaker a century ago. I just love precision machining. Now I had the enormously good fortune of running into and being introduced to our current CEO when I was looking for a board member, Nick Lazaris, who really took Keurig, the single-serve coffee-making company, from pre-revenue to its sale to Green Mountain and then the billions that it added to their valuation. Really spectacular guy.
This is a coffee-making machine, by
the way. Yeah, the Keurig single-serve coffee maker. Nick had relationships with a spectacular manufacturing partner in Hong Kong and China. Without them, Coravin would not have gotten to market.
Another key ally or person for you in this endeavor is Robert Parker, the wine critic. He basically has given it a wet kiss, which he never does. The last time he did it was with Riedel glasses, I believe.
Yeah, Riedel from Austria. I had the really good fortune of being introduced to him by one of our investors. Robert Parker is just what he appears. He is completely unbiased by industry and by me. And actually, he was, when I was invited to see him by this friend, I remember sitting down to dinner and he looked at me and he said, "I just wanted to let you know, I don't like gadgets. I don't think they work. I really don't understand what it is you're doing, but there's no way that this could possibly work." So I brought in a couple of bottles that I had been drinking, actually that had been rated well by him. He is the one that I followed for a while to try to, and still do, to really explore the wines of Hermitage and all these things that I loved. So I poured him a glass of wine from a bottle that I'd accessed probably 6-8 years ago. And as soon as he tasted it, he looked at me and said, "You know, this is the biggest change I've seen in wine in the last 34 years. I think I had a permagrin for about, I still do." He's a spectacular guy.
A permagrin. I like that. So was he just trying to be cheeky, you know, when he said, "Just want you to know I don't like devices," or was he actually being, you know, factual when he sat down with you?
He's a direct guy. And I think you need to be when you are in the wine rating world. It's a pretty hard-nosed world.
You were introduced to Robert Parker by your friend Jerry Facciani.
Yep.
How did you meet Jerry Facciani?
Jerry came to an investor meeting. I was trying to raise money, actually, for Coravin, our first big round here in New York. Jerry shows up at this meeting, and he starts helping me to set up for my sales pitch to this investment fund. And I'm thinking, who is this guy? Since then, and many people have told me the same thing, you meet Jerry Facciani and you fall in love with him right away.
So he's just a stranger who came up to you at a conference and he liked the product and he just wanted to be helpful?
Exactly. And he was close to Robert Parker and made the introduction by email and then was there when we went to dinner saying, "You know, Bob, you really need to see this."
We talk about key opinion leaders, and Robert Parker is that for you. Can you talk to me a little bit more about key opinion leaders in the medical device world?
Absolutely. The medical device world is very complex. There are regulatory, there's not only the human body and its pathology and the thing you're trying to solve and the variability from person to person, but there's also the regulatory world. Then there's reimbursement. More and more reimbursement is the number one challenge that a med tech company faces. The people that many of the government regulatory agencies and payers turn to are physicians that are the heads of their societies or have written extensively on a topic that you're working on. And it's exceedingly important to go see those folks very early on in the process, perhaps involve them in your clinical trials, so that they are aware of you. They know why you are trying to solve the problem, what problem you're solving, what you're good for, what you're not good for, so that when the agencies and the payers call them, they are informed. And if you don't, there can be a hostility. Why didn't you come see me? You know, why did you ignore me? So having had the experience of making mistakes in the medtech world, I brought that same philosophy of going to the key opinion leaders in the wine world first before we launched. And that was the top sommeliers in New York and San Francisco, the top wine producers in California, the top wine raters, both here in the United States, Wine Spectator, Robert Parker. Also over in Europe, Jancis Robinson, had the tremendous pleasure of meeting her. These are all really good people that have worked their way into positions of authority and trust.
So you benefited by getting the attention of these people early on, even before the ultimate development of whether it's a medical device product or the Coravin.
Yeah, I would do it in every company that I start.
It's striking to me that in the medical device world that they need to feel like they were in on it early.
I wish the medical device world were more objective. There are complex political issues associated with medtech, as you can see even now. So despite there are some companies that are successful despite bad clinical results, and there are some companies that are very successful or very unsuccessful despite excellent clinical results. And the difference between them is really, to some extent, partially involved with the luck and relationships that are developed early on.
In addition to Robert Parker being a key person for you in making the public aware of this, you mentioned some sommeliers in New York City were key. First was Mario Batali's restaurant, Del Posto, and now 11 Madison Park uses it. How important was that?
It was really, really important. And actually, we're replicating the same thing that we did in the U.S., in France, and in Germany, and in England right now. We would bring together a group of sommeliers at a dinner, access a half a case of a wine. So we'd take half of it, and we'd access it, pour it, explain the system to them, wait 6 months, invite them back to another tasting, have them taste blind to see if they could tell the difference between access and unaccess. This is 6 months out, some of them 9 months out. Number one, it was validation that we functioned, that it worked. That was really important. And number two, these people are deeply connected in the restaurant scene, in the press.
Was there any other key person or pivot point for you that's helped to get the word out?
Retail wine stores have been enormously important for our success. And they're great. They demonstrate the product. They can pour people wines before they buy. They can help them to explore regions of wine, to teach them, you know, what is an oxidized Italian wine and this type of thing that you would never have experienced before.
Now, I have to admit, my husband is a fan, but when I first heard of this, I thought, really, do you really need to spend $300 on this device? Like, does one really need that?
Yeah. You have to tell me. What's your conclusion? I'll try to bias you in advance. I think it's what Coravin is not a preservation system. Really, the advantage that Coravin provides, it's a new category. It's wine access. You can drink from any bottle you have at any time. You can serve any bottle you want in a restaurant or at home. You can pair wines. You can learn 6-10 times as fast about wine. And part of the pleasure of wine is its variety and and your understanding. You go into the average wine guy's home with a Coravin or woman's home with a Coravin, and on their counter, they'll have 6 bottles of wine. And they're drinking across those bottles over the course of a week, trying to learn something.
So if you reframe the picture from wine preservation to wine access, then it really changes the experience of wine drinking.
I think so. It changes. People have written me long letters where they say, look, you've changed my life. I had this cellar of wine that I wasn't drinking because I didn't know whether or not it was ready. And then all of a sudden, I start to access this wine and I'm tasting more, sampling more, learning more, understanding more, leaving the cork behind to do its preservation job is a really important thing.
How did you get the name Coravin?
Coravin was a knockdown, drag-out naming fight that took us months. Cor is the Latin root for heart, and vin from France, wine. So the heart of wine was what we thought, and brings in a little bit of my medical background. And my love of wine.
Your co-founder is Josh Macauer, a medical doctor. He's on the board of Intrinsic, your medical device company.
Josh Macauer is one of the most extraordinary medical innovators on the planet and an open-minded, optimistic guy who believes that absolutely everything can change.
What's an example of some of the devices he's invented?
Oh, he developed probably dozens. I think he has 6 or 7 companies running at a time. And one of them was Acclarent. Acclarent is an enormously successful company that solved one of the biggest problems in sinus surgery. People that have chronic sinusitis from a clogged nasal sinus. Mm-hmm. He developed this way that you can push a balloon up in there, inflate it, open up the sinus, pull it out, and you walk out of the doctor's office feeling better.
I love the transfer of technology in general from one industry to a very disparate other industry.
I think that it's always good to have the most open-minded and innocent people involved in the understanding of the problem and the creation of the first new idea. Mm-hmm. Frequently, the best ideas come from people who are outside of the industry because they're not biased.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Greg Lambrecht, co-founder of Coravin, a company that produces a device that allows people to access wine without removing the cork. This allows a person to drink one or two glasses without compromising the remaining wine in the bottle. I want to switch gears a little bit. I want to talk about your medical device profession. You've founded two companies. One is called Viacor, which allows subcutaneous cardiac valve replacement. And that company, the intellectual property connected to it was sold to Medtronic in the 90s?
Or? Yeah, it was it's a company of success and failure. It was my first med tech company. My mother has a leaky mitral valve. I tend to work on the problems of my family. And aortic valves, an aortic valve failure is a very quick cause of death. Viacor tried to fix the mitral valve through a small stick in an artery in your leg and a vein in your neck. And this, instead of having a cracked chest, open heart procedure to fix your mitral valve, we thought we could fix it percutaneously while you're awake. Unfortunately, we had some issues with luck. We had some issues with financing and management. So the company ultimately wasn't successful.
But the IP, the intellectual property, was sold to Medtronic.
It was indeed.
And are they using that process now?
You know, you find out whether or not they're using it when they contact you for patent extensions. So I'm constantly seeing new patents with my name on them from Medtronic. So it makes me happy that they're using it.
How many patents do you have?
I've lost count. Over 100.
Now, you mentioned Viacor just had ill luck. What's an example of that? Aside from management, which was subpar.
Raising money is a key skill of a CEO, and our CEO really wasn't terribly skilled at it, but a great, great guy. We had the misfortune of having an adverse event right when we were raising money. Mm. And despite the fact that we may have been better than any other procedure that's out there currently, bad timing can get you.
So you had tried the procedure and it didn't work.
In one patient, yeah.
A more recent company that you founded is Intrinsic Therapeutics. It's a medical device company focused on spinal disorders. Here, it's connected to a personal experience of your mother who had sciatica. Can you explain what it does and how your mom benefited from it?
It sounds like I only work on products from my mother. The most common problem in spine is a herniated disc. Herniated discs compress a nerve that goes down your leg and you feel this shooting pain. You get loss of function in the leg, loss of the ability to lift your toe off the ground, for example. The fundamental problem is that the disc is ruptured. It's like a tire, and the stuff on the inside of the tire comes out and compresses the nerves. We're a very intricate tire patch.
You've always had an interest in making things and fixing things. Did you, as a child, what are some memories as a child just being very hands-on in producing things?
I never really tolerated things that didn't work. I was also very positively influenced by my grandfather, who was a weapons designer during the last century. He sort of ignited my interest in making stuff, and the two of us would tear apart a bicycle and then rebuild it together. He was really my inspiration.
There's a story about him advising you not to make weapons, but to make things that were more positive. Can you describe that further?
Yeah. My grandfather was an Austrian. He wound up developing one of the first jet engines and then missile guidance systems for Germany during World War II. He was captured by the Americans in 1944 and was lucky to have been so, as he always told me. Wound up working on missile systems here in the United States, along with many other German scientists. And he came up to me, I think it was 1981, I was 11 years old, and he said, "We've made enough weapons. You should do something else. Medicine or power? We'll never have enough of either."
By the way, he was Austrian, so he was on the enemy's side of history.
Yeah.
How have you reconciled that?
Yeah, it's I was not involved, obviously, in what went on. And it was a terrible, terrible tragedy. And the Germans did some horrible things, as they know and as we know. I think ultimately what you try to do is take the best of it. And if I can work in medicine and make people's lives better, if I can work in wine, something that people are really passionate about. I had a surgeon tell me, I understand your career. You make stuff to make to fix us so that we can live longer to enjoy the wine that we really like. And I took that to heart. And so I think part of the influence of the negativity of World War II was to try to take my grandfather's experience in really destroying things and turn it into something positive.
And this is a man you love, obviously, but, you know, have you dealt with that complication?
Yeah, and, you know, I think people in World War II walked away from that experience being on the wrong side, one of two ways, either with, or maybe a combination, terrible guilt or denial. And when I talked to my grandfather about it, I remember I didn't have long with him. He felt both. Every country has its epic, disastrous behavior. You know, we had the slave history. We just need to recover, move on. Luckily, the younger generation seem much better informed.
Now, you mentioned you lived in California, but you lived in New York City in the Village up until you were 11. Do you have any memories or that feature in your past about what you're doing now, if anything?
Yeah, I think that the difference, if you were to contrast two places in the U.S., you could pick Newport Beach, California, and Manhattan, radically different. So, you know, New York kids go to the museum, right? They're interested in art and music. They don't get a whole lot of time on grass. It's a very intellectual world.
And was that for you?
It was. And I love that about New York. And then California is about the beach. It's about cars. It's about how you look and where you live. And actually, that was very informative as well. I became a big surfer. I love it. I loved it out there.
And in a way, this contraption is a fusion of those both.
It is. And you know, art and design have to meet up with purpose and functionality. I personally think that Corvin's a beautiful system.
And revelry.
Yeah, and joy, that's true. And there are joys on both coasts. I think they come from different places, but they're on both coasts.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It was really my pleasure.
My guest has been Greg Lambrecht, founder of Corvin. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Jessica Harris, this is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8"?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers, actually, who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, what about me? You know, they manage, they go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun, but, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, oh, we're so glad you're doing this. My husband's so happy and all that. And she said, there used to be a store in Washington that closed. And I said, oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that? She said, oh, it's called the Short Man Shop. And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this, and they go, oh, really? Yeah, that sounds interesting. You know, I do okay. And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, hey, you gonna do polo shirts?
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys department.
What is the tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the money, the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway signs are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched in February 2012.
Oh, yeah,
so,
we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that you're, you know, I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. But I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire, you know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band or he can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's just a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and turned it down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day going, oh, yeah, I got the show. It's The Sopranos. I remember vividly thinking to myself, wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type. Because I thought it was – I had no idea. I mean, that's – so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. And it kind of – you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And we're, everyone's working for nothing in a, conditions that are like, you know, almost tawdry. And you sort of do it and get it on and it works. And it just – I knew – and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just – I thought that's not going to happen again. So you know what? Let me just – put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought there's no way for both of us to have a really the careers that you need to have in the theater, because you have to give 110% of the theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant. And we had an incredible interview that where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, you know, it was work, so we were nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving. But he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and, you know, so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. You know, we were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer too, so she's got to sort of blaze that trail too and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia.
I did. And
focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who'd been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah. It's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows. And has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. You know, there's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving in the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell bottoms anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it vividly as, you know, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell bottoms is my rosebud. You know what I mean? So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, nine years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I have this mustard pair of, like, you know, sort of pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. You know, other five-year-olds are not saying that. And that doesn't mean you're gay. But, I mean, it was – so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hid it, and like lots of people did, and came out when I was 21. And everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, you know, from the age of five. How about your parents?
My mother was really – you know, she dressed beautifully. You know, she knew that girl. You know, she taught at a girls' school, and she knew girls were watching. So she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, you know, weeks and weeks on times. She always looked put together and always managed to, you know, look great on without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. I just it didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up, and so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and start this. And it's like this that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with retail. And I told her, I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They're starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands, and you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
What bank?
M&T Bank, mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I got started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan, and we're like, and I was like, we're off. Mm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we have a proven concept and sort of real growth. And people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. And when you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur, sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it, and everyone's going to live. And it, you know what I mean? When you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them. All of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, oh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player. And she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit, the weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going, ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and, like, be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to, like, look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and, oh, so interested in this humanities class and, wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home and because we were at the time, it was all in our house. Like one day a truck came and delivered all these boxes and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was. And I was like, there he is. He looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sidemen, and Sidemen being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, they sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sideman, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of here are these things, and he's sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.